This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Nicht warten, durchstarten mit Indeed. Beschleunige dein Recruiting jetzt auf indeed.com/julep. Mit einer Premium-Stellenanzeige wird dein Angebot ganz oben auf der Seite platziert. Für mehr Sichtbarkeit, damit du schneller die richtigen Mitarbeiter findest und einstellen kannst. Und das Beste, das alles funktioniert ohne monatliches Abo oder langfristige Verträge. Du zahlst nur für Ergebnisse. Sicher dir jetzt 75 Euro Guthaben auf eine Premium-Stellenanzeige auf indeed.com/julep. Es gelten die AGB.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
What do you picture when I say the word vulture? Giant, bald-faced birds with crooked necks, blood-stained feathers and huge, ripping, tearing beaks. Is that what you were picturing? Or a magnificent bird spreading its 3-meter wingspan in the sun. An elegant, curious, gentle giant of the sky. I'm Sasha Dench. I'm the UN's ambassador for migratory species. And I love vultures. Whatever you think of them, you might not know just how important they are to the ecosystems they live in, to us humans, to the whole planet. And you might not know that nearly everywhere vultures exist, right now, they're in trouble. Numbers have plummeted in the last few decades with declines of 80, 90 and even 99% in places. What's killing them is a complex picture with no easy solutions. I'll be honest, I was fairly indifferent to vultures myself until I flew alongside them. I am also a paraglider pilot. In fact, one of the conservation projects I'm best known for was back in 2016, when I flew a paramotor alongside Buick swans on their migration route from Russia to the UK. The media at the time started calling me the human swan, and it's a name that kind of stuck. But the first time I flew with vultures, I was blown away. Now, I never approach birds in the air, but some birds, like the vultures, will often come and fly right alongside you, and they are your best friends in the air, finding thermals at a distance that are invisible to the human eye, effortlessly navigating those complex air currents far better than even the best human pilot.
No, that's amazing, Sasha. I had a similar experience with a vulture in a glider in the south of France, and it was just astonishing. We were in the same thermal. And wow, being that close was really amazing.
I'm chatting with Professor Debbie Payne, a conservation biologist and a massive vulture fan.
I love vultures. I've loved them ever since I was a child and saw Jungle Book with the Liverpudlian accents, I think supposed to be the Beatles, of the vultures saying, what you want to do? I don't know, what you want to do? I've always loved vultures.
I haven't actually come to talk to Debbie about flying with vultures. I've come to talk to her about her experience of the most catastrophic decline of any wild species ever recorded anywhere in the world, an event which has become known as the Indian vulture crisis.
There are 3 species of vultures belonging to the genus or group called Gyps vultures. And in the 1980s in India, they were considered to be possibly the commonest large birds of prey in the world. And the reason for that is that Hindus consider cows to be sacred. So when they die, they're taken to these huge carcass dumps around urban areas, and then vultures would swoop down and pick a carcass of a cow clean really, really quickly. And this superabundance of dead cows provided a massive amount of food for vultures. So I love the idea that humans were doing something really positive for vultures, and vultures were doing something really positive for humans by making sure that cattle carcasses never rotted, they couldn't spread disease. So it was a real ecosystem service that the vultures were providing for people.
But by the mid-1990s, people had begun to notice fewer and fewer vultures around. The RSPB commissioned surveys to see if the declines were real. But the results were a shock to everyone.
The three species of vultures that you get in India had declined by more than 92% in 8 years. Now, that's incredible. That's an absolutely massive decline. We sat down and said, right, well, we've got to find out what's causing these declines as quickly as possible.
The race was on to find out what was happening to Indian vultures. What was killing them? There were a few hypotheses on the table. First, they ruled out contaminants, all the typical pesticides, agrochemicals or fertilisers that they might be picking up accidentally. And it wasn't any of them. They thought it might be a novel disease and spent 2 years testing and doing lab work. But it wasn't that either.
So after 2 years, we were all really worried because we thought we haven't worked out what it is and the declines are just massive.
What was it like working at this time, seeing all these vultures dying? Were you optimistic that something could be done about it, that you'd find an answer?
Emotionally, well, I mean, I'm obviously extremely unhappy if anything moves towards extinction, any species. But with this kind of problem, I tend to take a bit of a detective's view of it. So it's all about trying to do something about it rather than worrying about the fact that something's happened.
Eventually, frustrated by the lack of progress, the team changed tack. They turned their attention from what was in the vultures to what was in their food, the cattle, left out at those carcass dumps. Could it be something in their bodies that was causing the problem? The team surveyed all the various veterinary drugs that are used in cattle across Pakistan, India and Nepal, and they came up with something interesting.
One group of drugs that can cause kidney failure and birds are quite sensitive to generally are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs they're called, and they're very common. They found that there was one drug called diclofenac that was very widely used.
Those sacred cows are allowed to do something that livestock animals in other parts of the world almost never do. They get old. And in their older age, they're often cared for by animal charities who give them pain relief when they need it. Pain relief, like diclofenac.
And that really was a bit of a eureka moment. It was so exciting because we just didn't really know what to do next.
The teams knew they would have to push for a nationwide ban of diclofenac. But they also knew they were unlikely to make progress without an alternative vulture-safe drug to replace it.
And so at this point, Chris Bowden was brought on board to make sure that we could do everything that we possibly could to help them.
OK, so I'm Chris Bowden. I work for the RSPB, Royal Society of Protection of Birds. I have been involved with the Vulture Programme for over 20 years now, based here in India. I was brought in just at the moment when diclofenac was identified as the key threat across Asia. It was such a big breakthrough, and in some ways, it's quite a simple solution. All you have to do is remove diclofenac from the system, so that's been the challenge ever since.
There are dozens of anti-inflammatory and pain relief drugs on the veterinary market. Surely one of them must be a safe alternative for vultures. So the search began. They gathered a list of potential options, drugs they thought would be safe. And then the final part of the process was testing, feeding them to real captive birds and seeing what happens.
Because the populations were declining so fast here in India, it was going to be difficult to get permissions to test drugs on vultures here. And so we needed to find some way of doing that on closely related species. And that's where the South African team came in.
Could you just describe what we can see in the background?
There are a handful of white-backed vultures feeding off a carcass. It's pork today.
I've come to South Africa, to the Shamwari Game Reserve in Eastern Cape, to meet Kerry Walter, the founder and CEO of Volpro, at a rehabilitation centre for vultures.
I think they're watching us. I feel like I'm in a zoo. And that the vultures are watching us.
So we have about, 30 birds, some lying down, some standing up, some on a perch, all just watching us from above and from the ground.
Yeah, very relaxed.
Back in the early 2000s, when the Indian vulture crisis was at its peak, whitebacks, like the ones behind us, were plentiful. And Kerry saw an opportunity to help out.
I don't like testing, but sometimes to save a wild population, you've got to put your emotional feelings aside for the greater good of the species, which is what we did.
You've also then seen firsthand what drugs that are lethal do to a bird. Could you describe that to us?
Yeah, it's so hard to explain. How do you put emotions into words? You know, these drugs kill them within 32 hours. But for those 32 hours, it's horrible.
I must admit, it's a pretty sobering experience. For the first day and a half after being given the drug, they look totally fine and they're behaving normally. And then suddenly, within just a few hours, they go downhill quite fast.
These birds are so incredibly strong that they keep fighting until the very last minute. But their bodies internally are dying and shutting down. And yet they are still trying so hard to fight what is happening internally.
No, it's a dreadful thing to have to do. But without these trials, we would never have been able to get the drugs banned and taken seriously by the governments.
That testing, hard as it was for those who had to carry it out, eventually gave the teams the results they needed, a list of solid, dependable veterinary drugs that did the vultures no harm.
Meloxicam actually was the first drug that we tried, and thankfully the results of that work carried out in South Africa showed that indeed it was safe. We've actually quite recently been able to prove that tolfenamic acid, a second similar drug, is also safe. So at least the vets have two safe options that they can use.
With a safe alternative ready to go, the various conservation charities launched a huge campaign to get diclofenac banned for good. Now, I've been working in conservation long enough to know that getting national governments to sit up and even acknowledge problems like these, let alone pass legislation, can be a frustratingly slow process. This kind of change can take decades, and the vultures didn't have decades. But credit where it's due, they did take notice. In 2006, first in India, then Nepal, then Pakistan, diclofenac was banned. The conservationists celebrated, but the work wasn't over yet. The ban is only as good as the implementation behind it. And as Chris says, the fate of the vultures today depends on where you look.
They've stopped declining across most of India, but they're not yet recovering. The human forms of diclofenac are illegally used by some veterinarians in India even today, and that can be enough to prevent the vulture populations from recovering.
Just across the border in Nepal, things look really optimistic.
In Nepal, the vulture populations have responded, and for the last 6 years, they have been steadily increasing and recovering in Nepal.
In fact, the program has been so successful in Nepal that last year they shut down the last captive breeding centre in the country. It wasn't needed anymore. The wild birds are doing just fine on their own. And Chris was there when the final birds were released.
We all went down to the release site and witnessed the last 12 birds being released into the wild and joining wild birds that were feeding on the carcass just outside the release aviary. It was a real celebration, I have to say. It's demonstrating that what we've been doing has been on the right track for these magnificent birds.
I'm Natalia Melman Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the challenges of vulture conservation is that outside of the conservation community, it can be really hard to convince people that they're worth saving at all. Kerry, the founder of Volpro in South Africa, knows the truth of this.
People often perceive vultures as smelly species, which they're not. Scavengers like vultures, they actually get rid of their carcass so quickly and so efficiently. So they actually prevent disease outbreaks. They prevent blowflies, rats, feral dogs. They're our cleanup crews.
These days, Volpro is dedicated to rescue, rehabilitation and captive breeding, and it's much needed. Of the 6 vulture species that occur in South Africa, all are now either vulnerable, endangered or critically endangered. But the reasons behind their trouble here are slightly different.
Hey, Noddy, what's the matter?
Around 1,000 kilometres north is another of Volpro's rehab centres, this time just outside Pretoria.
I think everybody looks at a vulture and thinks it's an undertaker. And much like us, if we see a hearse going down the road or an undertaker, we tend to wince. We do the same with a vulture.
Alistair Sinclair is the manager here, and he showed me around.
Until you learn that each vulture has its own little identity, its own character. And once they're inside you, that's it.
When you're a carcass, you mean when you've fallen for them?
Yeah, when you fall, yeah. I like that one. Yeah, when you understand them and learn to love them, it's almost like it gets into your blood. Then it's over. It's tickets. It's a lifetime passion for the...
I've come here to talk to him about one very specific problem that they're encountering more and more often.
When we do the anti-poaching things, and yes, I used to run anti-poaching teams. One of the easiest ways for us to see where poaching activity takes place, you know, you'll look for circling vultures. You know that there's a carcass. And if there's a carcass in the middle of the felt, the likelihood of poaching is great. So your teams go directly to that spot. So to circumvent that, the poachers just kill off the warning, which is the vulture. They will sometimes put poison inside either a carcass or into the water points as well to purposely kill off the vultures.
So that's essentially preventative, to prevent the vultures from becoming sentinels, showing where a poaching kill has happened.
Absolutely.
The poachers can kill dozens, sometimes even hundreds of birds in one sitting, and all for nothing. The poachers don't even want the vultures, they just want them dead. Alistair told me about a recent mass poisoning incident and the effort his team had to go to save these stricken birds.
I received a call about 4 o'clock about a mass poisoning in Marlow Park, close to the Mozambique border. I grabbed the rest of my crew that was here, told them they had 1 hour to pack their stuff. We're going down to Marlow Park. We arrived at Marlow Park at about 2 o'clock in the morning to a scene of mass poisonings. And we formed a field hospital and we started with a conveyor belt with us treating the birds. Drips would go up, atropine would be injected, Baitril would be injected. They would then move on to the next person who would make sure that they were comfortable and fine. And so it went on until the night. So in all, we managed to rescue and save 17 of the 19 birds. And 10 days later, we managed to take them all the way back down to Marlow to release them. So it was a happy story and happy ending.
What's it like for your crew on site at an incident like that?
The passion and compassion that is generated by my staff is overwhelming, to the point that onlookers, paramedics for example, they couldn't believe how these birds are being treated. Wildlife rehabilitation, wildlife conservation, it's a calling, it's not a career, it's not a job.
Back out in the enclosures, Alistair shows me to the amputee ward, a special enclosure open to the sky where the birds with part or all of one wing amputated can live out their lives. Unreleasables like these are sometimes euthanized, but not here. Alistair points out a few of his favorite characters.
So those two up the top there, that's a breeding pair. They met up here in the ward and then became mates and friends. They gave us a chick this year. That's one of those that's going to be released. So it's a little happy story.
The vulture crisis generally, is it big enough that caring for releasing individual birds on this scale is actually having an important impact?
I'm absolutely positive, you know, that it is. The decline in vulture numbers is quite severe and their numbers are going to reduce more and more every year. So absolutely, I've got no doubt in my mind that are supplementing and reintroducing vultures into where areas that they used to be is extremely important.
Our final vulture story also comes from Africa, but a long way north in the small coastal country of Guinea-Bissau. The bird in question here is the hooded vulture, a slightly smaller species with a bare red face and the distinctive hood that gives the species its name.
Even in the capital, you can see them going through the parks and gardens and streets in the middle of the communities, in the middle of the villages.
They don't know a fear of people either, do they?
No. They literally feed within 2 or 3 meters of people passing by and so on. It's part of the urban life of Guinea-Bissau.
By this point, it won't surprise you to learn that the hooded vulture is critically endangered. They've been declining since the 1980s, but their already fragile numbers took a further devastating hit in 2020.
It is still to date the biggest vulture mortality event in the world. At least 2,200 hooded vultures were killed over a period of about 6 months to 1 year.
Meet José Tavares from the Vulture Conservation Foundation.
Dedicated to the conservation of Eurasian vultures. I am myself based in Portugal.
Can you take us back to the very early days of it? Do you remember the first reports coming in?
Yeah, let's start from the beginning. So in early February 2020, we started to receive some reports from Guinea-Bissau that vultures, hooded vultures, were being found dead in the east of the country. They were being reported that they were found together and quite a lot of them without their heads. We obviously suspected immediately mass poisonings, but we were not sure.
They seem to be happening at multiple locations all across the country at around the same time. It was all hands on deck to figure out what was going on. There was just one problem.
February 2020, Guinea-Bissau, which is one of the poorest countries in the world, was in the middle of an institutional coup d'etat. The country was completely paralyzed.
With the country deep in political turmoil, even getting people on the ground to collect evidence was proving difficult.
With a lot of effort, a couple of missions were organized. They visited 3 sites where mortality was reported. They collected 3 corpses, relatively fresh. It was a rather complex operation. I mean, even, for example, to find a reliable freezer in Bissau, in the capital, where these 3 corpses could be stored, was an adventure because, of course, people didn't want to put the corpses of these vultures in their freezers. By the time the numbers were growing, so by the end of February, we knew that at least 600 vultures were killed, probably much more.
At this stage, it still wasn't clear if this was a disease, poisoning, or something else. It was vital to get those 3 collected vulture corpses into the labs back in Portugal to be tested. But things were about to get even harder.
In the meantime, of course, the COVID pandemic, to make things even more difficult, burst into the scene and into the world, as you remember, in late February, beginning of March.
Amid the chaos of the COVID-19 pandemic, getting 3 potentially contaminated vulture corpses through an international airport was absolutely no one's priority.
You can imagine how uncertain and difficult this process was. A crew from an airline receiving a package that included 3 dead vultures. But nevertheless, this happened. These 3 vultures were flown to Lisbon. We took them to the main toxicological lab in Portugal in the University of Lisbon, which itself was then closed. But eventually, later on in 2020, the analyses were done and we received confirmation that indeed those 3 vultures were killed by carbamates.
What is that? What is carbamate?
Carbamate is a chemical compound. It's a pesticide, basically.
It's something pretty much anyone can get their hands on.
Yes. Well, they are actually banned because they are basically a very potent toxic killer. They are banned from Europe, but unfortunately not from Africa.
José and his team had figured out it was carbamate that killed the vultures, but the team still didn't know why. In India, the vulture deaths were an accident. In South Africa, they were collateral damage. But here, it seemed like the vultures themselves were the targets. Could this be accidental poisoning, or was there something more sinister at play?
In West Africa in particular, there is another driver for poisoning and killing of vultures, which is this belief-based use. It's particularly strong in West Africa. It also exists in other pockets of Africa. But basically, local communities and some ethnic groups believe that some parts of vultures have got supernatural powers, and they believe that if they have a vulture head, they will be able to see into the future. Some of these vultures that were found dead in these towns had their heads missing, which suggested indeed poisoning by belief-based use.
Belief-based trade of vulture parts is not uncommon in Guinea-Bissau or in the whole of West Africa. But over 2,000 birds in such a short space of time was unheard of. In the investigation that followed, they managed to zero in on what they think was the trigger for the whole thing.
You know, at that time where there was uncertainty, you know, COVID started coming about, but there was also significant political instability in the country.
André Botha is the co-chair of the IUCN Vulture Specialist Group.
And at that stage, there was a radio station had invited a cleric to come and talk to people and sort of placate them in terms of things will be okay in the end. And this person then made a statement of, if you have a vulture part of you, you should be okay. No harm will become you, type of thing. That seems to have been the trigger for this large-scale poisoning to happen.
Eventually, the investigation brought in suspects, or rather, a suspect.
And he was arrested with vulture heads in front of him, trying to peddle this to other people, and that's when he was convicted.
So at the time when one individual was arrested and convicted, it was reported as though this was the one guy, the baddie behind it all, and the problem is solved. Do you think that justice was served?
Maybe on the one individual, yes, but I don't think a single conviction is not necessarily going to turn it around. It's not just one person. There's not one individual that's involved in this. It's much wider and much larger scale.
This has become a growing challenge for conservation. So how can we tackle belief-based use whilst also being sensitive to people's culture?
Culture isn't a stagnant thing that's cast in concrete. The essence of culture is that you change to improve your environment that you live in and hopefully for others. And I think that's what we need to work towards, is to make people aware of the negatives of this while respecting people for who they are and what they are.
As with all conservation work, the story of the vultures is one with hope and despair, with lightness and also dark. Almost everywhere they live, they're in trouble. And almost everywhere they're in trouble, it's our fault. Now, it's hard not to sound a little melodramatic here, but our world as we know it simply can't survive without them. Ecosystems will collapse, landscapes will change, and diseases have the capacity to spread unchecked through the wild world and our own. But amidst all this doom, there are rays of hope. Everywhere vultures are in trouble, people are fighting, really fighting to save them. Fighting to ensure the future of this planet still has room for the magnificent 3-meter silhouettes of thermaling vultures. And fighting to change our perception of them too, from a screeching, blood-stained angel of death to the beautiful, extraordinary creatures they are. But we can't leave this fight just to the conservationists. If we're going to save the vulture, we need everyone on board. And that means you, too.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.